I want to try out some ideas on you this morning. I'm not sure that they're right. I don't claim to be a historian of the family, but these ideas are at least worth thinking about. Certainly, they put much of the conventional wisdom about the family in a very different light. In our straight society, and you and I are all members of that straight society, there's a great deal of hand-wringing and breastbeating about the fate of the family. There is a general feeling the family is disintegrating, and that without the benign influences, the capacity of the society to train up the young in the way that they should go will not be successfully maintained. It is in the family that we learn to love and to be loved. We learn to empathize and to care. Families impart values. The institution of marriage, it is assumed, is built on the social, is basic to the social framework, if not to individual happiness. Repeatedly, there has been a great deal of demonstration. Recently, there has been a great deal of demonstration of doom speaking in the popular press about the family. There is the mounting divorce rate, the indifference of many to their marriage vows, the generation gap. I don't know what the rate of divorce is today. I keep seeing different statistics, but clearly between 1 in 2 and 1 in 3 marriages ends up in divorce, which is many too many. The reasons for the disintegration of the family are many. One is the impact of the youth revolution. It's not a new phenomenon, but it's only in recent years that we began to keep our young in school beyond the 6th or 8th grade, so they were with their peer group for longer periods of time than they were with their families. They were out of their homes more than they were in them. The ability of the adult society and of the family to mold adolescent values decreased markedly. The values of their generational group, rather than of their families, are those which they now internalize. Doing their own thing has become the motto of an increasingly individualistic generation. Then there was the liberation of women. Not so long ago, a woman was looked upon as the linchpin of the tent that holds the family together. She was there, cooking, sewing, loving, looking well to the ways of her household, doing what mothers traditionally are assumed to do. Then in our generation, mothers went to work or went back to school, and the home became a place devoid of adults, and therefore, in a sense, no home at all. Many children spent their time in daycare centers or became latchkey children. Much of the debate about the family that is being carried on today is being carried out in a nostalgic haze. In the good old days, presumably, the extended family, mother, father, children, grandchildren, maybe a maiden aunt and an uncle who had been brought over from the old world and who was living in the home until he got himself established, was a warm, self-confident place where the father's authority was clear and was dominant. Most of us entered marriage as a sacred obligation, till death do us part. Most of us felt very close to our parents. We came to feel that there was something right in the institution of the home, and its values seemed to be confirmed by our religious tradition. Now, I will always be in favor of the home as a secure and rooted place, a place where there are a number of cross-generational ties and a variety of experiences, a place where the child is trained up in the way that he should go. But when we look at the family from a broad historic perspective, it appears that most of our thoughts about it are drawn not from the facts of history, but from one unique and special moment in time. The family unit for most of history, at least for most of European history, was not a place of intimacy. It was an efficient place. It was a survival unit. It was an economic unit. There was little interest or demand for the family as a place where one found friendship or any of the other deep and lasting emotional relationships which we associate with family life. Indeed, the family was not designed to be a sensitizing unit. In the older Jewish families, as there were essentially two separate worlds, the world of women and the world of men. These two worlds met rarely, probably only at the marriage bed. At the age of 3 or 4, a boy was taken from his home and put to cheder. Cheder was a single-sex institution. Only boys went. He spent there 6 days a week, 12 hours a day. And on the seventh day, the Sabbath, he went with his father to synagogue, a male institution. The young man met his wife at the marriage altar and almost immediately went back to the man's world, perhaps enrolling in yeshiva, a single-sex school away from home, where he was taught that all talk with women was trivial, vain, and led to sin. Such talk was to be avoided, not simply because it might entice you sexually, but because the women's world was the world of the trivial. Men talked about Torah, about serious things. Women talked about the home. Their talk was idle. More often than not, at a meal, the men sat down and the women stood behind and served. These people lived in a completely sex-differentiated world. Father cried when one of his friends died. I'm not so sure that he cried when his wife died, because he could always get another wife. Her value was essentially procreative. A husband might have 3 or 4 wives, because childbearing was a dangerous enterprise. When a girl was born, she was cuddled by a wet nurse. She was not sent to school. Early, she was put to work with the women, doing women's chores. Older women were her companions. She was taught the domestic arts by a grandmother or maiden aunt. She was kept in that woman's world, doing woman's things. Mostly, her contacts were with adult women. When she married, often at the age of 12 or 13, she set to work having children, doing that for which women had been created. Children were a threat to their mothers. It was almost suicidal to have a lot of children. Birth control was frowned on. Women did not rejoice when they became pregnant the way they do today, because being pregnant was dangerous. The mothers did not cuddle their children. They couldn't afford to. They couldn't afford to love their children, because they were going to lose 1 out of every 2 before the age of 1, and 3 out of every 5 before they reach the age of 5. How much can one person hurt? Better to be conditioned, not to love. It turns out that the good old days were not so good after all. The family lacked privacy. In the extended family, sex-differentiated roles were the order of the day. There was little chance for intimacy between adults, much less between adults and children. Men lived in a man's world, women lived in their own world. In the medieval family, there was very little human warmth. The members of the family simply worked together and subsisted under the same roof. Loyalty, not love, was the key virtue. Displays of love and affection were limited. In traditional communities of Europe, whether we are speaking of the non-Jewish communities of farmers or peasants, and the small shtetl communities of the Jews of Eastern Europe were tiny places by modern standards. Household numbers and number were numbered in the tens, not in the thousands. Yet the community was coherent and provided the feeling of coherence to family. The institution of marriage was zealously guarded. We know a good deal about the formal relationships which marriage established, a great deal about divorce and its procedures, but we know very little about the internal life of these families. The family was in that period an economic necessity. Whether it was a peasant family operating a cottage industry, or a shopkeeper's family providing goods to a customer, the family required a lot of extra hands. The strength of the family lay in numbers. There is no such thing as a pool of free labor. Today, there are few families who require such a number of hands to survive, but free labor can easily be hired. The Industrial Revolution, mass organization, and urbanization brought about changes in the traditional family patterns. Then the community was consistent and coherent with the values of the family. Today, the community is almost an alien force. We lock our doors against our neighbors. Today, competition forces us to be mobile, a fact which saps the roots of the community. To succeed, you may have to leave your roots and go wherever opportunity takes you. Then neighborliness was a basic requirement for survival. With a new order, it's free enterprise. It's you against everyone else. More and more, the family threw up walls against the outside world. The nuclear family emerged, paired of uncles and aunts and older children, because of space needs and the irrelevance of extra hands to the survival of the family group. The city is a crowded place, and a maiden aunt can have an apartment of her own. She's no longer needed around the house. Old folks are placed in institutions like Montefiore and Menorah Park. You can't keep extra people in the home in the limited space of a crowded, modern urban center, especially when they're no longer economically useful. The modern family, remains what it has always been, an economic and survival unit. The modern family, for the first time, has also raised questions of emotion and feeling. Who before the 20th century would have asked, can a person love who was not loved as a child? In recent times, husbands and wives began to talk to each other and began to be friends. They began to find that satisfaction of feeling that intimacy in human relationships yields. The family took on a new aspect, became the many-resourced institution that we think of sentimentally about today. Husband and wife bound together in ties of holy matrimony and affection, and children bound to their parents by ties of love and of beauty. Whether such ideal families ever existed, they have had to adjust in recent years to a rapidly changing environment, changes which have necessitated that the family pare itself down. Children are quite early sent to preschool. The husband is out to work, and now as often as not, so is the wife. Many families believe they can no longer survive on a single income. Everyone is busy following their own careers, including 4 or 5-year-old children. The familiar family is being subverted not only by external economic forces, but by internal forces as well, particularly by the television set. Not so long ago, when children came home, when the door was closed, the outside world was excluded. Whatever the family was like, that was the context of most of the child's life. Today, the outside world intrudes forcefully. You can't close your door to TV or to the radio. In many American homes, the tube is on from the time the child returns from school until he goes to bed. As a result, the family is no longer the crucible of a particular and special set of values. At times, this paring down of families makes it seem that there is nothing left. And so we have to ask the question, is the family irreplaceable? If it is, what will replace it? And then the next question, can Judaism survive the end of the family? Judaism existed and thrived for hundreds of years because of community. The traditional family was not a place of socialization, of feeling, or of emotion. It was, in fact, the community itself which created Jewish interest and Jewish identity. Community established what we now call Jewish values. It was in the community that one established one's basic Jewish relationships. These values were supported, but not established in the home. When I began to think about this lecture, I went to a temple library, which numbers now some 30,000 volumes. I researched carefully, and I could not find a single volume which presents a domestic history of the Jewish family, a collection of rabbinic texts which deals with reinforcing what we now call family life. Of course, a great deal of information exists on the contemporary Jewish family. Sociologists and psychologists have studied the family thoroughly over the last 40 or 50 years. But most of this literature does not question the role of the family and tends to assume that present family structures were almost always present. We have a good bit of historical and legal material on the family. We know the forms of family organization, but that's very different from knowing their content. We know how an engagement was decided upon. We know how a marriage was celebrated. We know something about the conjugal responsibilities stipulated by law for the husband and the wife. We know what were the responsibilities of parents for the training and education of their children. All these things we know because our legal codes of necessity dealt with them. But we can no more define the context of the Jewish family from post-Talmudic legal codes than we can define the inner life of the American family from American civil law. One of the things we do know about the traditional Jewish family is that it was entered into as an arrangement between families, and the basis of this arrangement was economic. The couple generally did not meet until their engagement or the actual wedding. There was no pretense at romance. We assumed that since the young people came from similar socioeconomic backgrounds, they would be compatible. Once the marriage took place, whichever partner left the family home dropped out of sight, as well as his birth family was concerned. Very few letters survive from mother to daughter or father to married son, unless some commercial interest is involved. Families did not stay together for reasons of feeling. A man may have loved his wife, but if she was barren for 10 years, he may very well have taken advantage of the legal principle which allowed him to divorce her. A son was more important than a wife, for the child could say Kaddish for his father. There's little evidence of mother love or fatherly love or of intimacy between husband and wife. In other words, there's little evidence from the legal documents of affect or of feeling, the emotion which we consider essential to family life. Despite this history, when the modern family emerged, Jewish life fell in step with it and declared it to be Jewish. I suspect that this occurred in largest part because of the desire of Jews to be emancipated and the aping of the bourgeoisie, the class that Jews desperately wanted to join. So we simply declared family relationships to be Jewish. I can find in our library hundreds of sermons, magazines, and articles written over the last 40 or 50 years, which eloquently testify to the importance of family and insist that at least the nuclear family is essential to Jewish survival. It was a social change that worked. The Jewish family became a success. Families developed that were strong and concerned with passing on Jewish values. The Jewish family was a new entity. Compared with the families of 4th and 15th century Babylon when the Talmud was completed. Society then was oriental. Marriage relationships were polygamous. Women were kept apart. The upper class kept their women in a harem and treated them to a large degree as sexual objects. The education of children did not involve what we think today of as guidance today. Patience, listening, endless hours of discussion. Well-off Jews raised their children with tutors and with nannies. The natural parents provided correction and guidance rather than a fatherly affection. Being a pal had nothing in those years to do with being a parent. How were values established? They were established through the community's culture. The community was the agent of socialization. The community established Jewish identity. It was through the community that Judaism passed from generation to generation. About 1750, perhaps a little earlier, in Germany and England, towns developed. Capitalism began to appear. And Jews began to think that there was a possibility of living someplace outside the ghetto and of being part of the larger world. The spirit of enterprise began to beat in the breasts of Jewish entrepreneurs. The most adventurous went to Amsterdam or Hamburg or London and left behind in the East, their extended families. The extended family could not go with them because of the cost, because of the government laws which limited the right of domicile to a restricted number of Jews. Beginning with urbanization and with capitalism, the modern family began to move away from any real sense of community. The calendar ceased to be the Jewish religious calendar and became the secular calendar. There was more contact with the non-Jewish world. Families became a series of little islands in the great Gentile sea. It was not an easy time. On the one hand, Jews wanted to be part of the larger world for themselves and for their children. On the other hand, they wanted to pull themselves and particularly their children out from this cold world in order to protect them and us and themselves from the pressures of anti-Semitism. Do you remember an advertisement which appeared in the popular press a few years ago? Family that prays together, stays together. The traditional Jewish family rarely prayed together. In the old synagogues, there's no such thing as a family pew. There still aren't in the Orthodox synagogues. Worship is highly individual, not collective. Each man comes to the synagogue and prays at his own speed. As the community began to wither, the family took on more and more of its functions. Because the human being can't live without intimacy and friendship, these values began to be found within the family. Although the ghetto was opened and Jews could leave, we faced an unwelcoming world. Jews were not really welcomed into the Gentile world, so we had to depend for acceptance and friendship more and more on our own families. Husbands and wives began to talk to each other, to relate to each other as persons, began to explore the cross-generational relationships, first between parent and child, then between parent and parent. A new world emerged. One indication of this new world is the flowering of motherly love. Medical science reduced the danger of childbearing and of infant mortality, so the mother doesn't have to face the danger of an early death. She can allow herself to love. She began to cuddle her children. She began to love. She began to allow herself a whole series of emotions which she had shut off before. She could allow her emotions freer rein. And as she allowed her mother's love to express itself, she found she could love as well as obey her husband. She began to hope that her daughter might find a man she could love and marry. About 150 years ago, the marriage broker began to lose out. As youngsters began to choose their own mates. How did they choose? Not by comparing family values, but rather by attraction, whatever that term may mean. Romance has intruded. A whole set of emotions now begins to intrude upon the modern family. Love, which includes friendship and intimacy, mother love, and the love of an adult for another adult, a husband for wife. It wasn't so long ago that children were to be seen and not to be heard. Today our children sit at the table with us and talk with us. Today our children are a central part of our world. Experience has made it possible for us to become sentient, feeling human beings. The nuclear family created a concept of personhood, which ultimately made it possible for the old sex-divided, sex-differentiated world to see men and women as people, as essentially similar. Today we live in a world which is happiness-oriented, which aims at self-fulfillment, where the motto is, do your own thing. The world of personhood has emerged, all to the good, but is it good for the family, and is it good for Judaism? In the medieval world, the community's values were ever present. Everyone grew to have a Jewish identity because that was the only identity one could have. The tight communities of the past no longer existed. Jews became, in modern times, monolingual, speaking the language of their country, no longer the language of their people. Families have their own calendar, birthdays, anniversaries, and so on. And more, their calendars come to play a greater role in their lives than the community's traditional religious calendars. The nuclear family does not automatically transmit a religious heritage. Jewishness is just one of any number of identities which a Jewish home wishes its children to have. The synagogue, too, has now become an outside institution, and so are all Jewish institutions. People are, without really knowing it, suspicious of all institutions, all structures outside the family itself, which is why almost every national Jewish organization of note has a commission on Jewish continuity. I don't think we can make the case that Judaism depends for its support on a warm, emotional family as we know it. Look at Israel, where the kibbutz serves as the center of secular Judaism, where the concept of family has been translated as something other, into something much more communal, something different from our notions of a nuclear family. The answer to the question with which we began, can Judaism survive the end of the family, seems to me to be obvious, a resounding yes. One can imagine any number of structures that provide for Jewish continuity better than the nuclear family does. When the time requires it, humans always have the ability to create useful new structures. What I see all around is an incoherent reaching out for community. You can see it in many ways. You can see it in the search of the young for communes, the search of rootless Jews for chavurot. You can see it in their interest in all manner of strange new cults, the ashram and chabad, where they seek and find community. They are finding a set of relationships which are intimate and closer than those available to them through their nuclear families. When the external situation changes, the culture must also change. All kinds of experiments are taking place in the area of the post-nuclear family. The most interesting of those studied is the Israeli kibbutz. But the trouble with all such groups is that they are new and that they are small. Very few people are involved, and there's little evidence of their long-term success or failure. Yet the statistics remain frightening. Since 1970, the American marriage rate has fallen 30%. The divorce rate has climbed 50%. It's estimated that 44% of all marriages formed in 1984 will end in divorce. There is another side to this picture. Many of us are reaching out for a sense of community. How many of every other Wednesday bridge clubs or stock and bonds groups have met for years? How many small groups exist where their papers are read or simply talk over communal concerns being the order of the night? But we are turned in on ourselves. Many of us are looking for something, someone to cut the strings out of our emotional corsets and let us simply be human. The nuclear family reinforces a sharp sense of our individuality. It has given people a sharpened sense of how they are different, one from the other. It has allowed us to change our responses and our feelings towards the opposite sex. It has not brought emotional stability into our lives. Rather, it left us with a feeling of disquiet and uncertainty. We live in a highly mobile world. Except in areas like Utah, where Mormons protect the extended family, or in Williamsburg, where Orthodox Jews do the same thing, it is a nuclear family which is in evidence in suburban life. There are today a large number of single-parent families, born largely of the increased divorce rate. There are singles who remain in that state much longer than heretofore. The family is threatened, and many ask, why marry? Let's return to our opening question. Can Judaism survive the demise of the family? Which is really the question, where will the next generation receive its Jewish values? And the answer, I believe, is from a variety of sources, including community. From traditional religious schools and family support systems, which a congregation like ours represents. From new generation places like the Chavurot, where youth and interest combine to create an intensive Jewish life. From the old extended family, all vestiges of which, of course, have not disturbed. Most importantly, from the nuclear family, which should not be read off too easily. It is for now and may always be the integral family unit. As such, it can impart values. That is, if it turns off the television set and recaptures for itself the meaning and value of a home. The nuclear family is in trouble today, not so much because of changes in the environment, as because of a heightened sense of individuality. The non-traditional family will make a contribution to the survival of Judaism. It will all depend on our basic and pervasive attitude towards life. Families are in trouble today, not because of changes in their physical environment. Mobility can be overstated, so much as because of changes in our attitudes towards others. We want what's best for us. We don't accept the duties of marriage, nor the duties of parenthood, if they begin to impinge upon something we deem more important. Yet if we concentrate on living up to traditional Jewish values of community and loyalty, we can internalize them in our home and make of them warm and inspiring Jewish places. Should we give up on the family? Emphatically no. The family remains the best civilizing agent that we have. Amen.